This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for being with us today. Reports surfaced this week that the Obama administration is considering changing senior members of its foreign policy team after its troubled reactions to several crises.
The Ebola outbreak and the rise of the ISIS, or Islamic State movement, have taxed the United States' role as a world leader and have sparked criticism from people on both sides of the aisle in this country. But a leading foreign policy analyst believes the issue with ISIS extends to a point before President Obama took office.
Graham Fuller is a former vice chairman of the CIA's National Intelligence Council. He was in Milwaukee this week to talk about the Middle East, and he joined us in the studio. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you. My pleasure, Mitch.
A number of people in recent days have pointed to a quote of yours that essentially lays the blame on the United States for making the rise of the Islamic State movement possible, if not likely. Why would you make that case?
Well, I think obviously we have to look back some years if we're talking – if we make that kind of claim. The Islamic State didn't come out – first of all, I don't really like the term Islamic State because it suggests that what we see with ISIS is what an Islamic State is or should be, and that's not in the eyes of most Muslims even what it should ever be. But ISIS, let's call it. You know, I think it clearly was one of the products of growing out of the incredible chaos and destruction of Iraq and the collapse of the entire state structure. So in other words, if we hadn't gone to war in Iraq, I think it's extraordinarily unlikely that we would have ever had the phenomenon like ISIS in Iraq. But as we know, a good 500,000 people died in that war. There's a lot of rage and anger. The country's political system was turned upside down. The ruling Sunni minority was dislodged. The majority Shiites came to power, who then out of their own anxieties have not managed the place, at least for starters, terribly well and somewhat discriminated against them. The infrastructure was destroyed. Probably 1.5 million people at least dislocated from their homes, both within Iraq and outside. So in other words, there were lots of reasons for anger and chaos to develop in Iraq, and ISIS is one of the outgrowths of that.
Is there anyone left in that region with any kind of leftover gratitude to the United States?
Well, that's a very difficult question to ask. I think American ideals are very valued still. I mean, people, Muslims and not just Muslims, I mean, people from around the world who come to the U.S. really appreciate the values as they see them lived in the United States and practiced by and large, although even that's beginning to weaken a bit. But I think the feeling over in that part of the world is that we don't really practice what we preach and that in the last decade or more that the military instrument seems to be our preferred approach to solving problems of the Middle East, where I'd have to say I think they have exacerbated existing problems.
Would you say is there any appreciable difference between ISIS and the Taliban? Is this just another manifestation of the same phenomenon, the next generation of the Taliban, if you will?
Look, I think it's useful to think of Islam and political Islam as a broad spectrum. And you can't simply grab onto any one group and say that this is typical or characteristic. There is a huge range of people who see a role for Islamic values in politics. But that can range from extremely moderate and very democratically oriented views, such as the present ruling party in Turkey, to middle of the road Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and elsewhere that renounced violence quite some long time ago, 50 years ago. Then you can move on to places like Taliban and then to bin Laden. And who could have believed it? But the ISIS, which makes even bin Laden in some cases look moderate. Bin Laden's al-Qaeda has denounced ISIS for what they view as extreme and unnecessary and counterproductive violence. So The Taliban, I think, at least restored law and order to a totally anarchic and post-war anarchic condition in Afghanistan and received some gratefulness for it, but it ran a very tough vigilante-type state with pretty primitive Islamic values in itself. But no, I think this is not even a state structure.
Well, and you mentioned Turkey as an example of how Islam and politics can, if you will, peacefully coexist. Should we be looking at Turkey, both the West's relationship with Turkey and the management of that country, as an example for how we might apply our foreign policy in terms of other countries, whether it be Syria or Iraq?
Constant intervention, whether it's military or non-military, has been the hallmark of the West's relationship with the Middle East for a very long time, especially if you go back to colonial days when it was a matter of seizing oil or energy resources and putting in dictators that would be favorable to the West, pliable to the West, starting wars in the region. I don't want to say that there were not often reasons for unhappiness with what's going on, but they've been feeding off each other. So I think a withdrawal of American military forces as the primary instrument of international relations in the Middle East would be a great start. And yeah, Turkey, I mean, is quite a remarkable state. It's made huge progress in many respects, sort of stunning economic progress and otherwise. But you can't always expect that states that are successful and democratic and even balanced are necessarily going to like the United States or let me say like U.S. policies. And this is, I think, a difficulty that the U.S. is encountering now globally, that it's one thing to respect the United States' accomplishments, but you may not want to buy into American approach to every foreign issue, well, even friends.
And I wonder, you talk about the perhaps over-reliance on military intervention in the Middle East as one of the recurring errors of U.S. foreign policy. And I wonder whether one of the things that ISIS is really relying on is the continued military intervention to continue to sort of foment opposition to the United States. Are we really playing into their hands?
I think you put your finger on it there, Mitch, definitely. This is part of – I mean, Muslims have felt for a long time that the desire of the West is to destroy Islam. I don't want to say most Muslims, but at least more radical Muslims are convinced that this is the U.S. agenda. And if you go back in history, it's not utterly unfounded. But sure, when ISIS in this hideous fashion beheaded on screen – three sad victims, Western victims, you better believe they got the attention of the United States extremely quickly. This was – you talk about shock and awe. This was an Islamic form of shock and awe. They could have gone out, let's say, and mowed down 500 people in the desert and fighting or battles or seizing a city or village. Yeah, it would have been on the news and it would have been too bad, blah, blah. But when you do something like that, you grab the world's attention right away. And I think this has sadly served to radicalize even some young Muslims, even in the West, who have felt, boy, this is what ISIS would like. This is the moment of truth. This is the moment when we and the West have this ultimate standoff. And sadly, this does appeal to people who for one reason or another, buy into a radical vision of global politics.
Well, and so what would the likely result be if the U.S. decided to start pulling out, kind of, you know, unilaterally pulling out of the Middle East, militarily anyway?
Well, a lot of people are afraid that if the U.S. pulls out militarily that this would lead to chaos. I would argue that we've got massive chaos now with several wars underway in Afghanistan, Iraq. I hate to say it, but they've been losing wars. If they were working, it would be one thing, but they're losing wars, deeply costly. In the end, I think these peoples, these populations, this is globally, not just in the Middle East, have to start solving their own problems. When you have a U.S. military occupation in Iraq, say, the Shiites go to the United States and say, what are you going to do about the Sunnis? Or the Kurds are going to come and say, what are you going to do about Baghdad? it's not our policy to be it's not our role to be a referee in these cases, and invariably we get blamed for failure to bring about solutions. So I think a little tough love. I mean, we went in and somewhat basically destroyed. Yes, we got rid of Saddam Hussein, who was not a very desirable ruler, for sure. But in the end, I think countries have to solve their own problems and learn to get along with each other. And they can and they will over time. But external intervention. I liken this sometimes to a mobile, you know, one of these things with all these hanging balls and everything. And I sort of sense that the U.S. is going in with the military and kind of grabbing onto a mobile and trying to, you know, stabilize it in a given situation. And then we let go and this mobile goes wild and everything, all the pieces fly all around. You can't ultimately, it has to reach some stability or stasis on its own, and I don't think we have facilitated that.
What about the idea of a moral obligation? When we see, you know, a dictator who is, in the case of Assad, really carrying out an assault on his own people, is there some place for the U.S. and the West to do something about that?
For a very long time, I had a lot of sympathy for the concept of exporting democracy and bringing it to the region. Sadly, over the years, I've had to conclude that I think U.S. policy is highly selective, if not even opportunistic in this regard. I'm sorry to say that. But we've been – there are good dictators if they like the U.S. There are bad dictators if they don't like the U.S. We believe in human rights, but where it serves our goals. I've sometimes said that democracy is a punishment that we deliver on our enemies but never a gift delivered to our friends, so that if you could have a Mubarak for 30 years in Egypt and much disliked by the people, but as long as he was friendly, we supported him. So in other words, it's highly consistent often very hypocritical, which destroys the credibility of these values. If we want to push democracy creation, let's turn to little countries that don't have the baggage who could – like Finland or, I don't know, Canada or Denmark or something like this that doesn't carry this massive geopolitical baggage that creates great suspicion about what our true goals are.
Well, and as you look at the situation in the Middle East today compared to where it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, this trajectory spans Republican and Democratic administrations.
That's absolutely right. And of course, the power of the Israeli lobby in Washington is legendary. It makes it very difficult even for rational discussion. I mean, the kinds of criticisms that you can read in the Israeli press about Israeli policy, nobody would dare reprint or publish or repeat in the United States. So we're being really more royal than the king in defending rather more extreme Israeli policies, I'd argue.
Well, it is a really tough nut to crack. Graham Fuller, thanks for helping us start anyway.
My pleasure, Mitch. Thanks for inviting me.
Graham Fuller is a former chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, a former senior political scientist at RAND, and currently teaches history at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver. His most recent book is called Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. Fuller was in Milwaukee to speak at an event organized by the Niagara Foundation.
Coming up next, four members of the team that produced a feature film on Lake Michigan think back on that challenging experience and the film that opens here tomorrow. We'll talk with them right after this.